Kia ora. Welcome to IOU, the University of Otago Alumni Podcast Series, where we get to talk to some of our extraordinary graduates about their out-of-the-ordinary day jobs. Today, we're very pleased to welcome Stephen Renata. Stephen graduated from Otago Whakaihu Waka with a BCom and a Master of Commerce in Marketing Management in the 90s. Stephen has worked in education and across a variety of marketing roles. He was a founder and CEO of global fitness company Les Mills International, and today is Managing Director and CEO of Kiwa Digital, a leading Māori-led creative cultural agency that uses technology to break down language barriers and amplify Indigenous voices. Stephen is of Ngāpuhi and Pākehā heritage. He was born in the far north and grew up in the deep south. In 2023, he was awarded the Matahiko Totara Award for service to New Zealand's public sector. So kia ora and a very warm welcome, Stephen.
Nā koe, Māori.
Well, it's a bit hard to know where to start because you've done a lot of interesting things, but I think probably the best place is the beginning. So if you could tell us a little about your childhood, moving from the far north down to Milton.
Yes, well, allegedly it all happened back in 1966 when my Ngāpuhi father, Charlie Renata, met the beautiful Pākehā mother, Carol Galley, from Milton. And they met actually at the Waitangi THC, which is now a different hotel. So Dad had just come back from the Malaysian War. Mum was actually hitchhiking the length of the country, heading for Australia and working at what was called the THC hotel chain back in the day.
All right, yeah.
Her and two girlfriends. Anyway, they landed at THC Waitangi and Dad managed to cross paths and she never quite got to Australia. So I was born in Kawakawa, but moved down to Milton about 9 months of age. So all my childhood that I remember is from the deep south of Milton. But yes, do have some Ngāpuhi whakapapa. And in the later years, I managed to reconnect with a lot of that. And I live in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. So it's sort of been a roundabout return to the origin, I guess. Grew up in Milton, great little town, you know, the classic sort of Kiwi country town. I was a townie. Most of my mates were cockies, farmers. And, I just thought living in Milton was pretty normal. Went to primary school there, went to high school there. These are all very small country rural schools. I think Toko Marero High School had like 400 students back then. That was form 1 to 7, which is year 13 to something backwards, which I can't even remember. So everybody knew everybody. It was a beautiful community to grow up in. And then I was lucky enough after that to sort of progress on to university at Otago. So, Milton, loved it. I think living in a small rural country community, later on in life you realise the values that you pick up from that small town life that actually serve you really well as an adult in bigger urban centres and if you go offshore and as a Kiwi. So, yep, I owe a lot of who I am to Milton and the people of Milton.
That's interesting. What do you think are the small town values or the Kiwi values that you get from growing up in a place like that?
In no particular order, the first thing that would come to mind for me would be just work ethic, just hard work was just the expectation. It was the norm. Of course you're going to work hard. And if you manage to do well through your pursuits, whether it's sport or school or work or whatever, is to remain very humble. I think the tall poppy syndrome comes from the belief that you should be humble first and foremost. So work hard, be humble. In a small town, everybody knows everybody, so you can't fool around too much. You can have a bit of mischief, but I think because we were a tight community, everybody kind of knew the rules, whether you're a child or an adult. Now, did that mean that we didn't have someone do graffiti or did someone not get drunk and driving or something? Of course we had that stuff, but they seemed to be more the exceptions than the rule. I mean, the thought that someone would actually get killed when I was a child growing up, Milton was like, that must be in America, right? I mean, it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Sure.
So it was sort of good old honest, hardworking, keep your head down, do well, look after each other, the whole community sort of thing, whether that was your neighbours or your friends. And I guess a little bit staying loyal. You know, I guess for us in Milton, we were incredibly loyal, like at rugby, you know, compared to our friends down in Balclutha or or goodness forbid, you know, the townies from Dunedin. So we were really patriotic as a small town, as a community. And I didn't realize how patriotic until I left and then went back and thought, oh yeah, you know, we really thought this was a pretty cool place to be, and we were proud of everybody and every part of it.
So from Milton, you then progressed to the big city, to Dunedin, and you studied commerce. Was that something that you had just always been interested in and wanted to do, or did you try a few things out along the way?
No, look, it was a complete fluke. My family would tell you that I was a sport fanatic. I was just crazy about sports, particularly rugby. And I think growing up in the 60s and 70s, I wasn't an unusual young Kiwi boy who wanted to play for the All Blacks, right? Yeah. So I was mad on rugby, and I followed that through. And I was very fortunate in my final year of high school to play for New Zealand secondary schools. And back in those days, this is going back 1985, it was kind of New Zealand secondary schools, New Zealand juniors or New Zealand universities, perhaps the Māori All Blacks, and then boom, you're into either regional or All Blacks. So I felt like, wow, you know, only a couple of steps away. And so I actually went to Otago University to play for the Otago University Rugby Club.
All right.
Because they had produced the most All Blacks. Just ahead of Ponsonby Rugby Club at the time. David Kirk was actually the captain.
That's right, yes.
The All Blacks at the time from Otago University. So I thought, I want to go where the, you know, the likelihood of being All Black is. And I wouldn't have called myself an academic at school at all. You know, I was so fanatical about sport. I was always a C+, B- type student at best. But then this subject called marketing popped up on the radar about 1985, 1986, and we didn't know what marketing was really as a university type subject. So it was kind of like the cool thing to do. And so I thought, all right, I'm going there to play rugby. I'll do the new cool topic, which meant I was by default in commerce. I'd had the physical education department trying to track me down because of my rugby connections to become a vet student.
Right, yes.
And I don't know why, I kind of dodged the bullet and thought, oh, I don't want to just be known for physical. I want to be known for my intellect. I know that sounds a bit philosophical at age 17, but that was kind of how I felt. And so I thought, all right, play rugby, do this marketing thing, and obviously tag on other commerce subjects that will give it sort of a rounded type thing. And in the end, I ended up doing a commerce major, but I did a few education subjects, like I did Te Reo Māori, et cetera, and education studies and so forth. But yeah, it was probably, I think it was the second year before I found the library. So I failed my first year. I got the E for enough. And let's just say that report card did not land well with my father.
Right.
At all, who basically said to me at the time, I don't know who you think you are and what you think you're doing trying to be a white-collar university person. Why don't you get a proper job, blue-collar like all the rest of us have? So it was actually a bit of a thing, you know. And so I was incredibly ashamed that I'd failed.
Right.
I'd done all right at rugby, but failed at the academic. And so me and a friend of mine who had also failed from Milton, we went back that second year with a bit of a vengeance, head down, found the library. And
good step.
Managed to then, you know, get on with it. So really enjoyed Otago University as well. I have friends, you know, 40, 50 years later from Otago that are still part of my life. And there was a lot of support at Otago to be successful. I mean, back in the day, allegedly the statistic was if you were at a university in Otago, you were in the top 7% of high school students. I never thought I was in the top 7% by a country mile. But if you're hanging around with people like that, there's a reasonable chance that some of that's going to rub off on you unless you don't want it to.
And what happened to the rugby?
The rugby, I was still going pretty hard, trying to make varsity A at the time. I didn't, and it was at a time when in Dunedin, I guess the wider Dunedin rugby community realised that all the top players were going to varsity, but you can only have so many people on a varsity being varsity A, so where were the rest going to go? And they tend to drop off. So there's a big commitment to the clubs around Dunedin University saying, hey, we'll take players from university as well. And they were sponsoring us in those days. This is before we went professional. So we had clubs turning up. You know, imagine I'm a student, right? I'm like 20 years of age. And a guy rocks up to your door, knocks and says, hey, guys, if you come and play for us at Ravensbourne, we'll give you a car.
All right.
We'll give you money for food.
Oh, wow.
Yes. We thought we were millionaires. So, you know, me and a few friends at the time, we went off to play for Ravensbourne, which I think amalgamated with Port Chalmers later on. And others went to Zingaree, Richmond and Dunedin. And so we sort of all spread out. I played club rugby for a couple of years and then I got quite sick. I got glandular fever twice. Probably from burning the candle, both ends too much. And I've basically had to finish rugby, which was devastating, you know.
Yeah.
And then that led to Les Mills.
Yes, well, I was just going to say, because after Otago, I think you went to AUT for a while, didn't you? And you were lecturing there in Māori tourism, is that right? And then that led on to Les Mills.
Kind of, yeah, it was a bit of a blend. So when I was coming through university, I was doing the commerce degree. I was trying to go hard out at rugby. It wasn't working for me. And as I was finishing off my BCom, I'd got sick. And it's time to pull away from rugby. And in fact, funny enough, it was my father who said to me, "Hey, man, you need to use your brain and less of your body to get on with life," which meant drop rugby. Right about the same time, I was a bit lost. You know, I've been playing rugby all my life. And, yeah. You know, so we got to put that physical energy. And a guy who lived next door, a guy who was living in a flat next door to me, a guy named Sam Taylor, said, "Hey, what are you doing for cross training?" And I didn't even know what cross training was. I was so ignorant. And he says, "Why don't you come down to the local gym, university sports and college place, and do sports and club societies in my school? Come and do an aerobics class." And I thought, hang on a minute, I think that's for my girlfriend and my mum, isn't it? Why would I do aerobics? Anyway, so I wandered down, and he was an Ironman triathlete at the time, Sam Taylor, fit as. So I do this class, I'm one guy in a class of like 30 women in my rugby gear, and they're in leotards, like, shame. Anyway, it was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. In fact, it killed me, especially the push-ups and all this stuff. So he says to me, "What do you think of the class?" I said, "Look, music was pretty cool. You were easy to follow. My coordination was rubbish. And I was disappointed in how many of the women beat me in the push-ups." I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll keep coming back to your class until I can do as many push-ups as you, the instructor." Well, that never happened. And so he then convinced me to go down to Les Mills, Dunedin at the time, and take some classes there, which were a little pre-choreographed versus freestyle. And, you know, you get fitter, more coordinated, and suddenly I've gone from the back of the class towards the front of the class. And he said, "Hey, why don't you go through one of the training programs and we'll make you into instructor," which I actually wasn't that keen on at the time. I was like, audience is a lot better than being on stage, right? Anyway, they twisted my arm and a couple of us went through. And so as I was finishing off my university career, which was moved from BCom into a master's, I was training up as a Les Mills instructor in Dunedin.
Right.
And the degree part was interesting. So I'd finished off my BCom, you know, sort of failed that first year, made a good finish. Holy heck, I finished my degree like 1989, share market crash. What department got what extinguished in every organization? The marketing department. So there were no jobs.
Okay.
So I'm sort of putting my CV out to all the big companies that have marketing and not getting very far. And then the head of Māori Studies, a guy named Godfrey Pohatu, who was head of Māori Studies at Dunedin, said, "Hey, we've set up this new postgraduate diploma. It's the first of its kind. And what they've done is they've taken the four papers that you would usually use in a master's degree, and you do the whole four papers first. And then if you want to and you succeed, you can go and do your thesis, do your master's." And I'd be initially failed, or not failed, but not approved to go into the master's program after BCom. So I was actually my summer holidays going, "I've got no job, I've got a BCom, what am I going to do?" During the holidays, they kind of rescue me at the university. And Professor Dave Fenby actually was the guy who grabbed me and said, "Hey, man, let's get you in front of the special group council and we'll take you through as, you know, one of our first Māori potentials." So, yeah, you know, I got that sort of, I got that green card to go on, we'll call it, you know, B's as opposed to A's in the report card. And I had to work my tail off that first year because I was there with students that were way above me. Anyway, did the four papers, and one of the papers was in tourism, which led into Māori tourism. So I ended up doing my thesis on the service quality of Māori tourism at the time. And back then it was things like Kai Koura Whale Watch was just starting.
Right, yeah.
So I went and measured the perceptions of the visitors before they took the tour, after the tour, the perceptions of the operators before the visitors came, and the perception of them after the visitors left. And it's called a gap analysis. And I got to travel all around New Zealand for my thesis. So I felt like I was on holiday.
It does sound good, actually, going well, watching for your thesis.
So I dropped rugby, got a BCom, I'm doing a master's, I'm now a Les Mills certified instructor, and those two parts of my life were cranking along pretty nicely as I was finishing up my time in Dunedin.
Right. And so how did you end up becoming the CEO, obviously from becoming a fitness instructor to actually being a founder of Les Mills International and becoming a CEO? Was it sort of internal through the company?
Yeah, and I think, as I'm saying this to you, I think my life is a classic series of right time, right place situations. So had a great time in Dunedin. I've come out of my master's, and again, this is sort of the early 90s when the funding for tertiary changed. So what happened was that polytechs were allowed to offer degree courses. Previously, it had been just certificate and diploma, you know, year one, year two, and universities were the only ones with degrees, which is where the majority of the funding went. So when that funding shifted, a lot of the polytechs around the country were going, hey, we can go headhunting staff. And so I had been doing some assistant lecturing at Otago University in the tourism department, and Otago Polytech gave me a ring and said, hey, we'd love to get you up here and we'll put you on this great salary. You're going to help write the degree for tourism, and you can have 9 weeks paid leave as well. Yeah. I was like, okay. So I went to Otago Polytech and got amongst the teaching staff there, which was just slightly different for university. It was a little bit less academic, a little bit more applied learning and so forth. And then while I was at Otago Polytech, AUT had just started a Māori tourism degree, and they had heard that I was at Dunedin, and they gave me a call and said, would you like to transfer up? At that point, I was also an assistant manager at Les Mills Dunedin. So I had sort of two jobs, Polytech and Les Mills Dunedin. And Les Mills Auckland said, hey, we hear you coming up. You can teach as many classes as you want. So it was kind of like I picked up my Dunedin life at tertiary teaching in Les Mills and picked up and went to Auckland. And so like everything went on to steroids. Biggest gym in the world, AUT, AIT back in the day. AUT now was much bigger than Otago. So it was like I was living my best life. And so once I arrived in Auckland, then I was fairly deeply in AUT. You know, you're writing a degree sort of stuff, and there was lots of offers to sort of do a PhD. And, you know, I was getting a lot of stuff as a Māori, I have to say. People were throwing stuff at me. And Les Mills was saying, hey, we want to go overseas and expand. So they sent me to Australia. So for a while, I had an AUT job, which was pretty full on. I was training for the Ironman, and I was going to Australia in the weekends to teach instructors how to do body pump. You can imagine, even though I'm 28, my life is starting to burn out.
Yeah, a lot of balls in the air there.
And so I ended up saying to both my employers, look, Polytech, do you guys want me? If you do, here's the terms. And Les Mills, do you guys want me to do something? And if you do, here's the terms. And in the end, Les Mills came back and said, yep, we'll put a deal together. And your first gig is you're going to Australia for 3 months. And so I was kind of a bit sad to leave my tertiary life because it was great.
Yeah.
But the Les Mills calling card at that time in my life was huge. It was, you know, it was like making the All Blacks.
Yes.
And getting paid for it. And so I went off for what was going to be a 3 month tour, and I never came home for 2 years.
Okay. Because you ended up in the States, didn't you? You were in San Francisco. Yes.
So with Les Mills, I essentially went off around the world for 18 years, starting off as an instructor, then becoming a trainer of instructors, then becoming an international trainer, then a international group fitness manager, facilitator, then the global sales manager, and then finally they gave me a territory in the United States as CEO. So it was like an 18-year progression, starting from the product, then working up to that CEO type level. So that was an incredible phase of life, you know, to be on the road. It was a bit tiring at times, you know, as much as we did, but the exposure to other cultures, the different types of jobs we got, places that we got to live, things that we were doing, you know, it was like being in a boy band.
So what did you really learn most from that experience? Because you then made quite a leap to Kiwa Digital, but you must have taken things that you learned from Les Mills with you.
Yeah, I mean, the Les Mills experience was a lot around, obviously, physical exercise and licensing that, you know, convincing club owners all over the world that, hey, you should purchase, subscribe to these programs that we put together, which have top quality exercise, top quality music, top quality training, education and marketing. So we had to think of a lot of different ways to convince the club owners all around the world that the service they were buying was legit and worth the money. And so I learned, you know, I did an MBA in sales on the road.
Right.
So by the time I'd been in the company, you know, at least 10 years, I had a pretty good understanding of how to run or be a CEO of an operation like that because I'd watched everybody do it and seen a lot of mistakes. So then, you know, we're getting towards the end of 18 years on the road. I'm married. We have a beautiful daughter. And my wife at the time, while we'd had our daughter overseas for the first 2-3 years, she was really feeling the pull from home. And as we're approaching Grace, our daughter's time to start going to school, she wanted her to start school back in New Zealand. And then when I came back, there was that kind of awkward moment of I'd been a CEO of an agency, but obviously back in international, there's already a CEO. Where do I fit in? And I think for anyone that's listening to this, it's been a CEO offshore. And if you come back to the parent company and you're not the CEO, it's a weird sort of a, oh, I don't know if I fit in anymore.
Yeah, strange dynamic. Yes.
Yeah. And so I guess the universe was saying it's time for me to get in my own waka. And so I was fortunate enough to have had a great CEO at Les Mills International called Jill Tattison for 12 years. She had left LMI about 4 or 5 years before I did. And so when I came back to New Zealand, she was the first person I called, said, hey, you know, what did you do when you left? And so we had a bit of a chat. And she said, look, while you're trying to figure out the next stage of life, I'm working with this little organization. It's education. It's international. It's got a bit of technology. And there's a little bit of Maori cultural stuff that I think you'll probably like. And we need some help with sales. And I went, sure. So, you know, I've just come off selling to the world for 18 years. Of course, I'm feeling pretty confident that I can do this. And so she introduced me to Rhonda Kite, who was the founder of Kiwa, a tiny little company. You know, we're talking single digits numbers. And I went, yeah, let's do it. And then, you know, it was several months later, I bought a major equity share and suddenly I'm knee deep in a tech company and didn't really know much about tech.
No, I was going to say, had you learned much about tech? Because
oh, yeah.
So can you give me some background into the ethos, really, and the purpose behind Kiwa?
Yeah, so Kiwa is a media technology company, and we've been operating. We operate in what's called the global language services industry. And for the listeners who are thinking, I've never heard of that, think translation companies.
Right.
So they're sort of like the biggest players in our sector. So at one end, you've got translation, which is done machine translation, human translation, hybrids, et cetera. And then over on the other end, you've got smaller elements or smaller players in that. So people that do dubbing. So Disney's Moana and Te Reo Māori.
Yes.
So they're some of the smaller players. And so we operate in that industry. We have two lots of technology. And the first technology is called VoiceCue. And that is technology that's used by audio post-production studios that do a lot of dubbing work. For example, Netflix, Amazon, Disney, they will have television series and films that they want to take from one language into another language or multiple languages.
Right, yeah.
The traditional way of doing that cost effectively and quickly is with subtitles. But over the years, dubbing has become very, very popular. So you replace the voice of the original content with language A, B, C, D, or whatever. The challenge is that for those who remember the old days of the Bruce Lee movies, the lips didn't match the voice.
No, that's right. It was always really frustrating.
You're either laughing crazily at it or you're completely frustrated and turned it off. We've found a way to eliminate that lip movement that looks incorrect and make people really enjoy dubbing. So much so that Squid Game, the world's most watched ever television series, which was Korean, dubbed and subtitled into many languages, but English being the big one for the US market, was dubbed using our software VoiceCue.
How do you do that? How can you manipulate the actual speaking? That's tricky.
It's a common question that I didn't know until I purchased Kiwa. So simple version for the listeners is that when you are dubbing, let's say a TV series or a film, you have the source language. And let's use Squid Game as an example. So it's originally written and spoken in Korean. So what you do is you take the Korean script and you translate it, in this case, into English for the American audience. So the translation is done. Again, it can be done in a variety of ways, machine translation, human translation, a hybrid of both. With dubbing, you go one more step. You take the translated script and you adapt the word or the phrases to make sure that the translation matches the lips.
That's quite complex.
That adaption, the adaption of the translated script, which you'll call it stage two or three, which way you're counting it, our software user face makes that very tedious, very detailed, often voluminous process, really efficient and really high quality. So when they use the adapted script, very much like karaoke,
right,
running across the screen for the voice actors, and they deliver those lines exactly as written in the adaptation, timed perfectly. When you look at that footage, you go, hang on, maybe that was actually filmed in English. It's that good.
What are you working on, anything particular at the moment with the dubbing?
Well, for us, we develop the technology and it's the studios that actually do the dubbing.
Okay.
We don't do the dubbing itself. So what we've been working on recently is having a version of VoiceCue as a cloud version. Up until now, we've got three applications, have been native, meaning that you download the software onto your device of choice and you don't need Wi-Fi or whatever. With cloud, it's obviously in the web, in the cloud. It's device agnostic. You can have multiple people working on it. It's like SharePoint and Google on steroids type thing. And that's been really powerful. So that's the first part of the business at Kiwa. The second part is the cultural part. So we have a second platform called CutPro, and that enables us to make native digital apps. Again, native not meaning Māori, but meaning you download the app onto your smart device of choice. You do not need Wi-Fi for it to operate. And we started off using that technology to build children's books.
Oh, okay.
So Harry McKillery from Donaldson's Dairy.
Yes.
We put that into the iPad with David Tennant's voice on it. So, you know, Harry McLeary from Donaldson's Dairy. And the idea with that technology, which is essentially an ebook, is that if you run your fingers across the text, it speaks to you. If you touch the word, it says the word. And if you double tap the word in English, it will spell the word. Or in another language, like Te Reo Māori, it'll phonetically pronunciate the word.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that's that literacy functionality, swipe, tap, double tap, really powerful for children in the early stages of literacy, you know, like a three-year-old trying to read and speak like a five-year-old. And what we found was that that technology works well with adults going from one language to another. So when I entered the company at Kiwa and purchased an equity shareholding along with Jill Tattersall, my former CEO, so we're partners, I said, hey, you know, I think that children's tech for Hedley McCleary could work to help the public service learn Te Reo Māori. And we sort of looked at each other like, wow, I don't know. Anyway, as chance would have it, we were talking to the team at Air New Zealand. This is about back in 2016. And Andrew Baker, who was the head of culture at Air New Zealand at the time, and he'd been there for over 20 years, said, look, Steve, I need some help. We need the staff to be able to say kia ora when you come on board the plane or at the front desk. When they leave, mā te wā, which means until next time. And if we could, no mai, hara mai, ki, enter destination, welcome to destination. I was like, it's like three phrases, you know. I said, you need our help. He said, look, it's just really hard getting people together. And this was before COVID. People weren't as friendly on Zoom and Teams and stuff like that. And hard copy just wasn't cutting it. So we said, okay. So we built our first cultural intelligence app for Air New Zealand called Te Kite Tikanga Māori, the basket of knowledge for Māori. And as soon as we launched that with his staff, of course, suddenly when you're flying, you started hearing people say, kia ora, mā te wā, no mai hara mai, kia ora te puti, you know, welcome to Dunedin. And it just made language accessible and safer for adults. And so that second part of the Kiwa business, which has become a cultural services business, has really taken off. And so most of New Zealand's central government agencies, a lot of local authorities, corporates, are our clients, and we've built tools for them to help them with their Te Ao Māori journey, learning a little bit of basic reo, tikanga protocols that apply to the workforce. And more recently, we've done a lot of work with Pacifica, which is actually 11 languages.
Yeah, you talk a lot about languages being obviously key to your breaking down cultural divides and bridges. Is that a central theme of Kiwa?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's being able to help people understand each other's cultures and languages, and I guess making their lives and their workplaces richer as a result of that. And so part of that is, for example, here in New Zealand, you know, we have over 100 cultures within the country, and what might only seem like there's a few languages, there's actually a lot more. And the first step into, I guess, multiculturalism is to understand when someone says maloa lele or ki orana or bulavanaka, what does that mean? And how do I say it? And if I wanted to participate, can I say it properly? Adults really want to get it right. And so we've tried to create tools that create safety for people to take that small step into another culture so that they can do it in a way that they feel comfortable, but they also can feel authentic in however they want to participate. We're not trying to make people bilingual or multilingual, but just giving those tools to take those first few steps. And then from there, of course, they can do what they want to do.
And is this being picked up internationally? I could see this having a huge market.
Yeah. I mean, VoiceQ, we've been international for 20 years.
Yeah.
So there's studios all around the world that are using VoiceQ technology for their dubbing, whether that's taking English content into non-English languages or from non-English content into English. The cultural services part, we've spent a lot of time here in Aotearoa working with Te Ao Māori, the Māori world, a lot of Pacifica, and now we're starting to branch into Australia, working with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island folks over there, and also in in America with the Native Americans. So we're working with Cherokee Nation, which is the largest of the Native American groups. So we're starting to see pockets of Indigenous groups popping up all around the world. There's an interest there. And I guess while everyone's on their journey, whether it's an education journey, whether it's workplace literacy, what we're seeing is that technology can play a role in accelerating that and helping that progression for everybody, whether it's the Indigenous group themselves or those that are trying to walk across the bridge to the Indigenous group.
So you've produced digitized books and apps. Are there other projects that you're working on, other technology that you're using?
The next big one for us is a bigger platform called Culture Q. So if you ask folks about who's Kiwa and if we park VoiceQ for a minute, they go, oh, yeah, that's the group that make apps, which we do. We've made hundreds of them. What we're looking to do now is have a platform that the apps is almost one output of what we can do. So with CultureQ, we'll have a cloud-based platform that will allow groups to archive their assets. So assets can be text, audio, video, imagery, etc., in multiple languages, maybe, or multiple dialects. From there, then they can start to curate those assets into things that they would like to make themselves, and then they can deploy them. And one of the things they might deploy is an app, but they can equally deploy it as a video or it might be a television series, or it could be a website, anything that's got, you know, digital sort of media attached to it. And that would be a platform that people can subscribe to. So there'll be various iwi around Aotearoa, Aboriginal groups, Native American groups, Canadian groups as well, and then across into the European nations that want to have that full platform to do the things that they want to do. So apps have been great, but we think there's a bigger solution that could be offered.
I read you talk about localization quite a lot in your work. Is that part of it? Is that sort of giving a holistic kete basically to people to be able to use in their area, in their way, in their culture?
Absolutely. Localization is a small word that means a lot of things. So one form of localization is language, of course. So if you've got content, for example, one of our clients is in South Africa in a company called Amafu, and they were given, I think it was like 90 episodes of a television series, and they were asked to produce that in three languages. So I've started language one, and you want to have that. It's like 274 episodes, 14,000 minutes of content. So the question is, are we going to do subtitles? Are we going to do dubs? Are we going to do both? And the answer is they did both. So you can do it. That's just one project.
Right.
Other localization can be when you're looking at content and there might be some, say if we're in English and there's a joke that's made or a colloquialism, a slang term that we use, we realize in the country of audience, that joke, that slang doesn't make sense or it lands really badly.
Yeah.
And so you alter the languaging to maintain the intent, but to make it land in the audience's culture. Otherwise, you either got it completely wrong,
yes,
or it lands really badly. And so there's a little bit of work in there that can localize. Localization can also mean looking at even like design, iconography and colors. For example, in Māori, if you've ever got a face, a head, you want to also be very careful that you don't ever cut the photo so the head's cut off in any shape or form, which might seem quite an innocent thing to do. You know, the photo's got Steve's forehead slightly cut off. That's seen as, you know, tapu is a little bit sacred that you do that. Or perhaps even writing across someone's head, you know, in an advertising type thing. So again, that's another type of localization. So I guess broadly speaking, localization is taking the content from its origin, and when we look at the target audience, making sure that it is appropriate and accessible to the target audience. Audio description is another way of localizing. So audio description is if you had some content playing and you had low eyesight, low vision, so you can't actually see the pictures as clearly, you would have a narrator between the scenes. So a scene occurs and perhaps a man and a woman are on the scene, and you'd hear very quickly between their voices, which is normal, woman arrives, looks at man. Man is beating foot. So what it's trying to do is fill in the gaps so that if you've got low vision, you can understand the actual visual side of it, even though you can't see it properly. So that's another form of localization, audio description, which is quite common. So, yeah, there's our technology. We're always looking at localization in a broad sense. Our first go-to is, can we make it more accessible with language, and then look at other opportunities.
What about the way you work, Stephen? I've read something about your approach to leadership. Can you explain that for me?
So looking through a cultural lens, I guess, how would I describe it? A sort of a tribal nature. So we treat staff as whānau and a little bit less hierarchical. So it's sort of more of a collaborative approach, being very respectful of people's backgrounds, which can be cultural. It could be gender-based. It could be age-based. So all of those things that are in that, those diversity, inclusive conversations for us, that's just that's a normal hygiene factor for us. Of course, you would do that. Also looking at leadership from a, I guess, an empowering perspective. So if I use the cycling analogy.
Yes, I've read that you're a keen cyclist.
Yeah, a weekend warrior. It's probably the best description. But yeah, I'm a fitness fanatic. I love fitness. I think it's an important thing in this day and age. But if I think of professional cycling, the Tour de France. So you've got all these people cycling and you have the Marjon, the tour leader, the person in the yellow jersey. Now, that person who is arguably the best cyclist in the world is very rarely at the front. The Marjon often sits just slightly back from the front in the group, occasionally right at the back. So being able to lead from different positions within your organization is my belief, is that you don't always have to be the person out in the very front barking, everybody do this, do that, and apply a little bit more of an influencer perspective. A mentoring perspective. And then sometimes, yes, you got to get up the front. In Māoridom, when you go into the marae, you know, one of the men, the kaumātua, needs to get up on the paipai and lead. And so at that moment, you take that position, but then be quite comfortable with stepping back. A personal perspective here would be, I think I'd be right in saying I've had my best results in my professional life working with females. And I think part of that is because I don't have a fear or an ego working with females. I've never, ever tried to dominate females who have been my leaders or my peers. I've realised that very early in my professional career is that you can learn and win a lot from wahine. And I'm totally comfortable in a wahine working environment in a very respectful way. And when I need to be whatever the man is supposed to be at the time, if they say, then I'm happy to do that. And I think for a lot of male leaders, this is a new thing to get your head around. And if you can get your head around it fast, you'll go well. You'll go very well. Also, I think, as you know, I'm 58 now, dealing with the Gen Ys and the Gen Zs. As a Gen Xer, I think it's the official title, babies close to baby boomers. How do you actually lead and influence the Gen Ys and Gen Zs? And all I can say is it's been a learning curve, you know, because my old school, is what I tend to fall back on, that doesn't work. Mm. You're saying, well, this is how I did it in my day. You know, the young ones will just look at you cross-eyed and go, nah. So you've really got to learn how to adapt with that younger generation and figure out what are their motivators. A little bit of old school will work sometimes, but if you use that one size fits all old school rules, I don't think you're going to be able to manage younger generation workforce.
So finally, just to ask you, and it follows on from that, what would you say to our young Tauira today, to, you know, people at Otago, students at Otago today, looking back on your journey, maybe looking forward to their futures? What kind of advice would you give them?
I'd say, first of all, really embrace your time at Otago, whether it's, you know, you're there for 1 year or you're there for 7 years like I was. Embrace your time. It could be the best years of your life. You can have fun and sort of experiment and try different things, meet lots of people. And if you make a mistake, there's not such a big consequence. Once you get into the workforce, if you make a mistake, it can be quite tough. So enjoy that time. I think also is that you have a lot of people around you from different backgrounds that can give you some guidance. You know, I was the kid from Milton. Suddenly I'm hanging out with all the Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch private school people. And I learned a lot off my friends from those schools. Yeah, I did feel quite inferior in some aspects, but over the years, it paid off, those relationships. I think keeping a connection with the university when you do move on as an alumni member is important because it's a good grounding to be able to sort of reflect back on the university itself and the connections the university has. You know, I noticed when, especially I was in London, we'll be chatting away or whatever. If I mentioned that I was from Otago, and sorry, Auckland and Massey, everybody else, but straight up, if I said it's from Otago University, that was like a secret handshake. So the mana that the university has picked up over the years is enormous. and don't underestimate that, is what I would say. And again, it's probably a bit cliche, try and find something you love. You know, you're going to be working for the next 40, 50 years of your life.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you're not asleep and you're not playing, you're working. And if you can't find something you don't like, that's, you're starting to grind pretty quick. And I was lucky with Les Mills. You know, I loved fitness. I loved music. I got paid to fly around the world. It was like the dream. Yeah. Kiwi's actually been a bit harder for me. So, yeah, find that passionate thing. And I think if you don't find it straight away, because sometimes I see a lot of pressure on younger people to, you know, you got to get a career and you got to have a pathway and it's got to go here, here and here. Look, I was still trying to figure out my life at 35. You know? And then I went to Kiwa from 18 years of fitness at, 45 years of age sort of thing. So don't get too pushed into a corner that you have to be somewhere at some time. At the end of the day, love it. Be the best you can be at it because you get rewards for that. Sometimes it's not financial always. It's just, you know, you've done a great job. You've made a real difference in people's lives.
Yeah.
And I'll leave you with this. As I had this mentor in the States. It's going to be a bit of life coaching. And he said to me, Steve, it's not the things that you've done in life and achieved that you'll be remembered for. It's the way you make people feel. And I've never forgotten that.
No, that's a very good thought, isn't it? A good thought to end on as well. Thanks so much for talking to us. That's really interesting. And thanks for sharing all your stories.
Thank you, Margie. And mō i ora ki a tātou. E te whānau.
Ka kite.
Ka kite anō.
This podcast is part of a University of Otago alumni series presented by Margie Clark and produced by Fiona McDonald from the Development and Alumni Office of the University of Otago.